Sonny Osborne after last week. Nice discussion of the new release of Nashville, which is the last Osborne Brothers tunes in the vault. He wanted to come back on again and just talk about Rocky Top, the song. He wants to get the truth out now. The full story about Rocky Top and how it came about. It's probably buried within one of those 12 or 13 conversations that are on the website on Unreal Bluegrass already, but we're gonna focus just on Rocky Top so we can get the full story. And that'll be fun. It's always nice to visit with Sonny Osborne a little bit. All right, we're leading up to having Sonny Osborne on the phone. I think I've got him. We got all of our phone problems solved, so let's try this. Hey, Sonny, you there?
I'm here.
All right, man, you're sounding good. I think we got all of our issues, our technical issues were solved before we dialed in Nashville. Must have been something out in Oregon. I was talking to a band out in Oregon this morning.
Yeah, I can imagine that. It's probably raining out there on top of that.
Well, we had a good time last week talking about the new Nashville album, which is, as you say, the last one, the last Osborne Brothers tunes out there in the vault yet to be released, and it came out on Pinecastle, I guess, last Tuesday, the 10th, and it's all good stuff, and we talked about that a lot last week, and we decided we ought to revisit Rocky Top.
All right. That's a good subject right there.
It is a good subject. And then we're going to talk about the Sweatin' to the Oldies DVD that Sonny's going to put out.
Not hardly, brother.
Not hardly. What people don't know is that you ride your bike this morning, you're going to go work out today at the gym after this is over, and you know Sonny's just a lean, mean fighting machine right now.
Well, not hardly. I'll be 77 in October, and I would like to make it to 80 if I could. And from there on, it's just a toss-up. So.
All right. Well, you and I have chatted about Rocky Top before, and but let's get it. You know, the media won't cover this story, Sonny. You know, they buried this one. They want to hide the real true story of Rocky Top. So you're going to get a chance to lay it out there for everybody right now.
All right. Starting when?
Well, starting when you get the Bryants are writing songs, and they have a song for you, and then you go over and listen to it. And I know it's a slower version. And then you make some modifications, and then just kind of take it from the beginning of Rocky Top.
Well, to start with, I knew the Bryants from the early 50s when I worked with Bill Monroe when I was 14. And we recorded, and in the studio that day was Ludlow and Felice Bryant. That would be 1952, I think. 1952, and Ludlow sang bass on Walking in Jerusalem Just Like John that Bill Monroe recorded, and he was there to do that, and that's when I first met them, and Ludlow and I became good friends and had been good friends since then, and we recorded a couple of other things that he had written, Memories Never Die, and Lovey Told Me Goodbye, and several things that Ludlow had written, and Ludlow and I just became very, very good friends. We had a lot of things in common other than his success and money. We had a lot of things in common, I'll put it that way.
Well, Sonny, for the people listening, in case they're not familiar with how many songs and for how many people the Bryants wrote, just a little rundown of what you can think of off the top of your head of all the great hits they...
Just Plain Old Country Boy of Jimmy Dickens, All I Have to Do Is Dream.
All those Everly Brother hits, right?
Yeah, Wake Up Little Susie, Bye Bye Love. They had an instrumental called Mexico that sold several million records before it ever came here. Love Hurts, the rock tune. And I tell you what, somebody about 1970 or thereabouts had one of their sons did this, had figured out that they had sold 200 million records by 1970, and it's probably double that or triple that by now.
Wow.
And you get to thinking about that, that's selling a record to every human being in the United States at that time.
Yeah.
That's a bunch of records, huh?
Yeah, so you got to meet them and hooked up with them, and you talked about...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so...
We got to be good friends, and I lived about a mile or less, I guess, from Budlow. And so if we get down to this Rocky Top thing, 1967, I think Rocky Top was recorded in October of 67, and we were going to do a session for Decca. As I recall, it was a Wednesday, and it would be a 6 o'clock session, I think. And so Bobby and Dale Sled and I, and maybe Ronnie Blackwell, was going to rehearse that morning at my house in Hendersonville. And so we didn't have enough good material, I thought. And we needed another song. And so that Tuesday, I called Budlow and asked him if he had anything for us. And he said, "You know, I don't think so. I don't think I've got anything you can do." He said, "I do have one song that is not completed yet, and you might be able to do it." And I said, "Well, I'll come over and listen to it." So that Tuesday afternoon, evening, I went over there and listened to a slow version of Rocky Top that Budlow and Police had written during a time when they were writing an album for Archie Campbell in Gatlinburg at the Gatlinburg Inn. And so I went over and to Budlow's house and I listened to it, and I wasn't jumping up and down over it, but in 66, we had done a song that the Wilburns had recorded, and it was a song called Roll Muddy River, which the Wilburn brothers did a slow version of that, and what we did was double the time on it, and it made us a very good record, Roll Muddy River.
Oh, that's a great record.
That came out in 66.
Yeah.
And so I heard this, and I thought, you know, perhaps we could double the time on that and it would make a pretty good song. And so I called Bobby and I said, "I'd like you to come over to Budlow's house and listen to a song and see if you think we can record it." And so he came over there and listened to it, and I explained to him, I said, "You know, we could double the time on this and make us a really good bluegrass song, and that's what we wanted." And he said, "Yeah, we can do that." So I told Budlow, now this is the way I remember it. Budlow and Felice, they remember the song already being done, but I don't remember it that way. I told Budlow, I said, "If you can finish this song and get it over to me in the morning, we're going to rehearse about 9 o'clock over at my house." And I said, "If you can bring that song over there, we'll run over it a few times, and then tomorrow afternoon we'll record it." And he said, "Okay, good deal." So that next morning, about, I don't know, 8:30, 9:30, Budlow shows up with that song, And Bobby and Dale and I and Ronnie Blackwell rehearsed it just several times. I mean, two or three, four times. It was an easy song for us to sing, and it's simple. It's just a very simple melody. And so we said, yeah, we could do that. And that next afternoon, in the recording studio, to stop right there for a second.
Okay.
We had recorded everything since 64, I think it was, 63 or 64, that Doyle and Teddy Wilburn's publishing company, Surefire Music, had published or one of their writers had written. And that includes Up This Hill and Down and all this stuff that we did, Roll Buddy River, and everything that we recorded up to that point. And so we got down, and my favorite memory was also on that Rocky Top session. Now, to go back to a Rocky Top session.
Mm-hmm.
And we had done My Favorite Memory, and so Doyle and Teddy both were in the studio, as well as Owen Bradley, and they were our production team. And, of course, we didn't call it at our time at that time. But they were in the studio and said, okay, what's next? And we started running over this Rocky Top song. And I think it was Teddy or Doyle. It was Doyle. He pushed the button and he said, whose song is this? And I said, it's a Boulogne Police Bride song. And he said, we didn't publish this song. I said, no, you didn't. But we're going to do it. And so Teddy Wilburn just got up, and he said, I'll have no part of this. And he left the studio.
Wow.
And eventually, in a few more minutes, Doyle left too. And that kind of broke our relationship with the Wilburn brothers, and which we owe just about everything that we've succeeded at, we owe to the Wilburn brothers, because they believed in us when nobody else did, and got us a record contract, got us on the Opry, and just over and over, and booked us through their Wilhelm booking agent. And I hated that happened, but I really believed in that song, and Bobby did too. And so we recorded it, and strangely enough, we recorded that as a B-side. Now, every single record back in those days that came out, an A-side was the one that you had most confidence in, and then a B-side was the filler song. Good song, but a filler song. And we recorded Rocky Top to be the B-side of My Favorite Memory, which was written by Daryl Statler and from the University of Texas, and published by Surefire Music. Well, the thing about it is, Doyle and Teddy got mad over that, but they had the other side of it. And if Rocky Top sold 30 million records, they were going to get paid for 30 million records too.
Right.
Because they had the other side of it. But obviously they didn't see it that way. They wanted everything. They wanted both sides. And but we just had enough confidence in that song. And when Boudreaux Bryant writes a song and gives to you, you'd best record it, because it's a well-structured song. It's put together well, with a lot of thought and a whole lot of experience, successful experience. And so we recorded it, and it came out on Christmas Day of 1967, and which was the only time that I ever remember Christmas Day being a release date for our record. I don't ever remember seeing another one like that, but it came out on Christmas Day, December 25th, 1967. Well, our contract with Decca was up at the end of the year, and so they got us in real quick and signed us to a like contract that we had before, which was the most simple, unrewarding contract you could ever have, but it was a record contract on a major label, one of the biggest labels in the world.
Oh, yeah.
And so they knew this, but we didn't at the time. So about the just after the turn of the year, we signed that contract. Well, two or three days after that, Boone O'Brien called me and he said, "Man, we've got a monster." And I said, "You'll have to explain that to me." And he said, "Rocky Top is going to be a major hit." And I said, "What are you going on?" He said, "It's been out 10 days and sold 85,000 records." And for anybody, 85,000 records in 10 days is a lot of records. But for a bluegrass band to sell that many records was absolutely unheard of.
Well, and Sonny, too, think about the market you're in right now. You're in the Christmas season, and it's not like it's a Christmas song. So all of a sudden, this tune is hit, and it's out of control. I mean, it's selling unbelievable. Those numbers are unbelievable.
Yeah, and then that was just the beginning of it, too. And it forced radio stations to play our records, and it was just a phenomenal success. And all through the years after that, and my favorite memory, it was a great song, one of my favorite songs that we ever did, ever. And but it became the B-side of Rocky Tops, which is not all that bad when you get around to it. I wish I'd written the other side of Rocky Top.
Well, and is that, Sonny, is that the song that you were trying to do more of a ballad to stay in the charts longer? Did I remember that correctly?
Yeah, the reasoning behind that is that historically, a fast song, if it was really good, would get in the charts, but it would only stay there a week or two or 10 days or something like that, and it may go up to number 3. But it would only be there for just a couple of 3 days, and then it would fall out. A fast song, historically, was like that. But characteristically, I think I should say.
Right.
But a ballad, if you got a good one, it would go on a chart that stay on. Ray Price had songs that stayed on, those ballads that would stay on the charts for a year. I mean, and they almost stay in the top 10 for a year.
Wow.
I mean, that didn't happen every time, but he had some songs that did that. Other people did too. Eddie Arnold. And you can go right down the list. Farron Young, Carl Smith, those ballads would just stay in the charts so much longer. And we thought that we needed that in order to push us over the top to the place where we wanted to be. And so that's why we really believed in My Favorite Memory. We thought that song would do that. And when the record came out, we were promoting and pushing, trying to get Ralph Emery at WSM, who had the all-night show at the time, to play My Favorite Memory. And he started playing Rocky Top. And I thought to myself, why in the world is he playing that? Because we want him to play the other side of it. Well, he was getting requests for Rocky Top, and he didn't get those same things from My Favorite Memory. And so Rocky Top became a major, major hit for a lowly, dirty-playing bluegrass band. I mean, And country people, they thought bluegrass music was dirty. They didn't want no part of it. at all.
Dirty.
And it's always been that way.
I've never heard that description. I've never heard anyone think about it as being dirty. I know what you mean.
You haven't been around long enough. Yeah, I'm serious.
Okay.
They used to call it, in the beginning, it was blank kicking music. And you can figure out what you mean by that.
Yeah, I believe I could.
By bodily waste. But that's what it started out as, hillbilly music. And then it graduated to this kicking music. And I don't know why. I have no idea in this world. Don't know why. But that's the way that it was It was recognized. And when you played a banjo or something like that, I mean, that was just unheard of and dirty. I mean, just, they didn't want no part of it. But we took that and succeeded with it. And we actually, what I told Bobby, I said, you know, when we saw that it was going to be a major hit, I told Bobby, I said, you know what, we beat them at their own game. And we did.
Yeah.
And everything we had then started selling, because you had hundreds of people, thousands of people that had never heard or took the time to listen to us, including disc jockeys. And they thought, my gosh, if they can sell that, I bet some of the rest of the other stuff is good too. And so they would play our older records, Up This Hill and Down, The Kind of Woman I Got, Roll Muddy River, and all that stuff started selling too. And it was, I mean, Rocky Top was just phenomenal. It was amazing what it did to our career.
Ace.
I mean, you just can't, the right words have not come up in history yet.
Hey, Sonny, is Rocky Top the song that as you were driving through Nashville, you were flipping through stations and you heard it so many times out the dial?
I was, yeah, it is. I was on the way to downtown to do something, and in my truck, I heard it being played on a station that was I don't know the difference in hard rock and soft rock and acid rock and or whatever kind of rock, but it was a rock and roll station. And I used to remember the name of that call letters. But I thought, my God, they're playing Rocky Top on there. Our record is Rocky Top. And so I turned the dial, and I heard that thing six times across the dial. And that's just unheard of. I mean, you know, that's major hit stuff. We were just so fortunate, so lucky to be the people that did that song first. And then, now I can't remember the years that this happened, but it also became an official Tennessee State song. It is right now. It was the official fight song of the University of Tennessee. And there's a lot of people that don't want to admit that. And it's still, right to this day, that thing about bluegrass music, but they don't want to admit that. But Rocky Top was major. It was a really major thing. And it was recorded also by Lynn Anderson. And to prove my point, we outsold her on that song probably, I'd say, 4 or 5 to 1.
Wow.
And her record went to number 3, I think it was now, and ours stopped at number 28. Yet ours was much, much more popular, and hers went up to that and came right down in no time at all. And it was just amazing, absolutely amazing what that song did. And still to this day, I'm sure when Bobby does it, now I've been retired since 06, I think it was. But up until that point, every time we do Rocky Top, it's still people ask us to do it over and over. We go to a place, and you wouldn't be there 10 minutes after you got off the bus till somebody said, hey, play Rocky Tom. Be sure you play Rocky Tom. It's just, and honest to goodness, you could go from it to any country in the world, maybe excluding Russia and or China, or those other places over there, the stand places, Afghanistan.
All the stands. All the stands.
Yeah. And I'll bet you that you say, have you ever heard Rocky Top? Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I know Japan's like that. I know England's like that. France is like that, but don't want to be.
Hey,
you know about me as France.
Yeah, I do. But, I do.
And Sweden, Switzerland, Germany, we did all those, and Rocky Top just as famous there, just as popular there as it was here. It's amazing, absolutely amazing song.
Sonny, I have
but
a question.
It's catchy. It's just catchy.
It's a great song.
Got a good melody to it. And Budo told me it had been out, oh, probably 10 years. And he and I were, how would I put this, partying a little bit at his house. And he said that they had made more money off Rocky Top than, other than maybe three or four other things that they did. And it was equal to what they had done off some of these Wake Up Little Susies and
wow,
Bye Bye Love and all that stuff.
That's something.
Oh, they also wrote Love Hurts. At,
oh, that's right.
Who did? Deep Purple did that, I think.
Deep Purple.
Okay. Yeah.
Hey,
that's
son,
a good name for, that's a great name for a band, isn't it?
It is. Hey, so, do you think that Decca knew when they came to you by the end of that year, did they know the song was doing well?
Oh, they knew it because the sales figures went through them first.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And they got us in there before we found out,
okay,
and signed us to a contract, which gave us nearly nothing. And we could have demanded 10 or 15%, 20% more, more than that, probably, I'd say three or four times what we signed for. We could have demanded that much, and they would have had to sign us. Because when you have a major hit like that, everything that you record after that is going to be, it's going to sell really, really well too. And so they knew that though. And what are you going to do? You know, when you're beggars, you can't be choosers. And we didn't know that Rocky Top was going to do that. We had no idea. We were pushing the other side of it.
Is there a little bit of a bump for Rocky Top whenever the University of Tennessee with incoming students do? I know that they all, I've seen singles of it flying around, is the reason I say that still.
Yeah. A guy named Scott, oh my gosh, Scott's, I can't remember his last name. Isn't that funny? I think that's called age. But he put together a four-part Rocky Top thing, and it was our original song, a recording of it. And then he took parts of that and mixed it like to rock, it was really strange. But that thing, for the longest time, every time football season would come along, that sales for Rocky Top would go up like 20,000, 25,000. So it's unreal. And I was also told that they play it, even now, they play it 46 times a game. And that's basketball and football.
Really?
Yep.
46 times a game? Wow.
And in 1988, I think it was, 88, agent, I guess it was Smiley Wilson at that time, had called us, and maybe they called me, I can't remember, but the University of Tennessee was doing homecoming with Alabama football teams, and they wanted us to come over and play Rocky Top at halftime. And I said, well, yeah, heck yeah, we'll do that. And so we went over there, and Paul Brewster was with us at the time, and we stood on the 50-yard line and in front of 105,000 people, and I'd say probably 80% of them were singing Rocky Top along with us.
Wow.
And then the Tennessee band, I think, was 180 people strong, 187 maybe. And they were playing with us. And see, we had Buddy Spiker and Chris Wilkinson had written a score for Rocky Top that a band like that could read. And to hear them, and I mean, these kids are stretched out all over the football field from one end zone line to the other. And we're right in the middle of them. And you talk, oh my gosh, that was the most mixed up thing. We were going to do Tennessee Hound Dog and Rocky Top. And they've got that thing down to where you've got like so many seconds to do this and so many seconds to do that. Jay Julian was the head of the bands at UT. He's standing on a platform about, oh, I guess 30 feet to our right. And he introduced us, and of course, you know, most of the people, heck, they didn't know who we were, but they knew that song. And he introduced us, and he pointed at me, and Jimmy Bronk, J.D. Bronk, our bass player, couldn't get his amp to work. I said, the bass amp won't work. He said, and Judy said, play now. I said, the bass amp's not working. He said, I don't give a damn what's working and what's not. Play now. Oh, my gosh. And so I went into it and started playing, and I mean, you could hear the banjo rattling all over the world. I mean, it was just coming to me from all sides. And just at that exact moment, his bass amp started working. And what had happened, somebody had unplugged it, and Raymond Huffmaster, the guy that was driving for us right then, he went around there and he saw where it was unplugged, and he plugged it back in, and right exactly at that time is when it started working. Right when it needed to work, it started working. So the Lord had his eyes on us that day, I believe. Anyway, we played Rocky Top for him, and it was an amazing thing. I think Bobby may have gone over there since then. I'm not sure about that.
There's one more story that I remember about Rocky Top, and it really isn't about the song so much, is that the Osborne brothers were preparing to play with an orchestra out west somewhere. Do you know where I'm going with this?
San Antonio, yep.
You were playing with an orchestra, a symphony orchestra, and yep. Rocky Top fit into that. Do you remember how it fit into the discussion when you were preparing?
Well.
'Cause this cracks me up.
We had, as I told you, Buddy Spiker and Chris Wilkinson had written out 7 of our songs so it could be played by an orchestra and the music in front of them and the whole bit. I mean, it was professional, big deal. And we did several shows with orchestras like that. We got the idea from the McLean family, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
Because they were successful at that, very. And we didn't want to compete or anything like that, because they were really good at it. But I just wanted to know whether we could do that or not. And that was the reason that we did it. And so Rocky Top was one of the songs. Well, we were doing rehearsal with that orchestra the day before we were to do the concert. And we started playing, and this whole row of violinists was sitting in, and we're looking at about a 60, 70 piece orchestra, 80 maybe. They were good too. They were very good. The best one we played with was San Antonio. And we started playing, and I hear this thing's kind of snickering around in back of me, and I was right, they were right straight in back of me. And of course, they're trained musicians. They hadn't heard what we were doing. They had no idea. And I guess it seemed kind of funny to them. And it just kind of, the more I thought about it, the worse I liked it. And so I just stopped, and I stood and turned around right in front of them, and I said, you know what? When you get a record made, released, and it'll sell 6 million copies, then you can laugh all you want to. But until then, you be quiet and do your job. And they, you know, these violinists, they looked around at the conductor, James Tadaris, I think was his name. And he just looked, he said, he told you right. Shut up and do your job. And then Blaine Sprouse was playing the fiddle with us at the time. And these violinists, they don't know, they have no idea how that we can stand up there without music and do all this stuff. And what I'm saying is they don't understand the concept of playing by ear. And by ear, for those out there who might be listening and don't know, that's just playing ad lib.
Right.
Because you know your instrument well enough, and you know the song well enough, and you know how chord changes goes and all that. And trained musicians, in my mind, they're great players. They really are great, great players. Far ahead of anything I could ever do, but they have to have it written down in front of them a lot before they can play. And so that's the difference.
Right.
And I'd rather be on my side than theirs. It pays off better.
That's right.
But
it's hard to argue. When you turn around and say when you sell a record, 6 million, it's hard to argue with that. I imagine they did get hushed up quite a bit.
Yeah, but I don't know whether it was told that much or not. I made that number up.
But it worked.
Yeah. Well, I imagine it had sold pretty close to that. I really don't know. Yeah. I have no idea. I have no way of knowing. And I really don't care. I know what our popularity went from a 2 to a 9. And it caused us. You got to understand this. Those big record companies, for vocal group of the year, let's say, just that, because that's what we were competing in, vocal group of the year from the CMA, which is a big time. That's a big time award. It really is.
It's huge for a bluegrass band.
For a bluegrass band, it's unheard of completely, and I'm not sure it's ever been done since.
I don't think it has.
Before.
I don't think it has.
But anyway, we should have won that in 1968 or 69. But RCA bought a block of memberships from CMA. They had the Stoneman family at that time, with a record out. Just, that's it, a record is all it was. And so they instructed their whole Blanc vote to vote for the Stoneman family, which they did, and they won it in 1968 or 69,
okay.
Which we should have won it right then. I was told later we should have won it, but we didn't. And in 1971, we did win the Country Music Vocal Group of the Year. And for 6 years in a row, we were in the top five finalists for Vocal Group of the Year from the country music side.
Wow.
And then they also had a Bluegrass Band of the Year award, and we won that from 1970 to 1980, 10 years in a row. And Rocky Top by itself, Rocky Top was the reason for that. So Rocky Top was you can just say, you know, you owe your career to that song. And we did. I mean, it's always to it.
Well, and we've talked about this before. After that happened, well, then you had the selection of songs that came to you as a band. Did that change also?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Good writers, too.
Yeah.
Really good writers. We never had one of that magnitude after that, or before that, for that matter. But we had, I think it was 21 chart records from, and I'm talking about Billboard, Record World, and whatever the other one was. But we had 21 chart records, and I don't know if anybody has surpassed that bluegrass, but Flat and Scruggs had 20.
How is it that you happen to know that number versus yours?
Oh, I'll never forget that. Oh, my gosh.
Oh, boy. Well, that's...
my career has been just a fairy tale, really. I mean, you know, we were always, Bob and I were always standing at the right place at the right time. And when the Grand Ole Opry came up, when Decca Records, of course, I don't know how we got the Grand Ole Opry thing through Doyle Wilburn. But then we also, he got the Decca Record contract for us. Hold on.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, I'm back.
Okay. All right. Are you situated down there?
Yeah, I'm okay now.
All right. Well, we were talking about you being in the right spot at the right time in the Grand Ole Opry, and you know, but you took advantage of the opportunities.
Yeah, and it just right, you know, instead of being out of town, we were always there, you know.
Yeah.
And a lot of things came up to us like that, and we took advantage of it. We had a good career, though.
I'll say you took advantage of it. Well, listen, man, it's always good to chat with you and set the record straight on Rocky Top. We've got to find some more things to straighten the world out on. We can do this some more.
There's been, I've seen several interviews lately where that story was told wrong. And that, what the story I just told you about, that's exactly how it happened.
Well, as you know, Sonny, I always believe you.
Well, I was there.
All right. Listen, I'm going to...
I was there.
Sonny, I always appreciate you being available and sharing your stories with us, and just appreciate you as a friend, too, bud. I really do.
Well, it's good to talk to you, brother.
Yeah, man, always.
Go ahead.
Always. It always is. We'll find some more things to bring up.
Yep.
All right.
I'll talk to you soon.
All right, Sonny. Thanks a lot, man.
Okay. Bye. Yeah, bye.
There, that's the true story of Rocky Top. From the man who ought to know. Isn't amazing? It's amazing. You know, he talks about being in the right spot, but man, you have to be able to deliver. And the Osborne brothers always did. And if you look back through their career, there's just milestone after milestone of things they were able to do so well. And I appreciate Sonny for coming in and sharing those stories with you. I think it's something that's important to do, and I like it a lot. Thanks a lot, Sonny Osborne.